It's a great honor and pleasure for me to introduce to you His Serene Highness Prince Albert II of Monaco. His Serene Highness succeeded his father, Prince Rainier III, as head of the principality in April 2005. Since then, His Highness has established the Prince Albert II of Monaco Foundation and contributed significantly to global discussions about climate change, the Arctic, and now the Antarctic. It was through his inspiration that Monaco became the 47th and most recent signatory to the Antarctic Treaty. For his leadership, Prince Albert II has been awarded many recognitions, including the recent Roger Revelle Prize from the Scripps Institution of Oceanography for his role in protecting the environment on a global scale. To an international champion and a friend, it is a great honor and pleasure to introduce to you His Serene Highness Prince Albert II of Monaco, who will share with us the opening keynote on humankind and our polar regions. Your Highness.
Thank you very much, Paul. Dr. Clough, Dr. Nina Fedoroff, Your Excellencies, dear members of the International Committee of the Antarctic Treaty Summit, ladies and gentlemen, dear friends, all eyes all over the world are about to focus on Copenhagen. I'm pleased that you are all gathered here this morning for this meeting dedicated to the 50th anniversary of the Antarctic Treaty, and I'm extremely proud and pleased and honored to be a part of these celebrations. The legitimate unrest and anxiety we can observe around the summit in Copenhagen, which will be determinant for the future of the planet, and where I will be honored also to be present, must not allow us to lose sight of the fact that not everything will be settled there. Nor should they allow us to forget that considerable progress has already been achieved that should serve to inspire us. Of the determinant victories already won in their day, the Antarctic Treaty is a particularly enlightening example. As is the case wherever the problem of environmental protection arises, the major issue in Copenhagen is that of the interface between scientific research and policymaking. It is also that of the transformation of scientific truth into collective choice. Such transformation is never easy nor natural. Regardless of their accuracy, scientific facts cannot conceal the complexity of a decision that must include other issues and take into account other interests. This is why it is so important today for us to be able to examine the case of the Antarctic Treaty, which is both exemplary and, alas, unique. 50 years ago, when 12 countries decided to pool their efforts to preserve the Antarctic from all territorial claims, they probably had no idea of the meaning their action would take in the light of the current situation. They could not imagine that saving our now endangered planet would become our main concern. They could not have known that the poles, until now the embodiment of the power of wilderness and wild expanses, would become the symbols of their new vulnerability. True, the Madrid Protocol provided a useful addition to the treaty in 1991, giving it an essential environmental dimension. In fact, all it did was to reassert its original spirit, that of an area dependent on the shared responsibility of mankind, a continent whose collective importance requires defining the boundaries of special interest. It is the spirit of today's meeting to emphasize the primordial importance of these deserted expanses for mankind, expanses with almost no human beings, but also without which all of us could no longer exist as we have so far. This is why I spoke of a case that is both exemplary and unique. with the Antarctic Treaty, political decision preceded scientific certainty. In a way, it even preceded the threat. But beyond the realities of its time, it also set out a universal philosophy for the preservation of higher interests of mankind. And it made it possible for nearly 10% of the Earth's surface to escape national interests and be dedicated to peaceful purposes. Given today's very different realities, this is a success that should inspire us. It will be difficult, but not impossible, since we have other assets, including the certainties acquired by scientists in the past 50 years. We now know the challenge confronting us. We now know what is at stake, our prime interests, our very survival. Threat, fear, often triggers new momentum. I was able and honored also to go to Antarctica last January, where I was able to visit 26 different research stations with dozens of researchers of different nationalities. And I'd like to pay tribute to their dedication, to their passion, to their selflessness, of all these men and women who devote years of their lives trying to understand the complexities of our world. We must recognize today that their work is often insufficiently heeded by those who should be its natural extension, political decision makers. In recent decades, scientists have been warning us of our planet's degradation. But for decades, our economies, short-term interests have been privileged. The international agenda is brimming with more urgent tragedies and crises with more immediate effects. Fortunately, things are beginning to change, since scientists have succeeded in mobilizing increasingly vigilant public opinions. The world over, we can now see the emergence of a new global awareness, our most valuable asset. We can simply remember all the preparation for the Kyoto Summit and observe the considerable changes over the last 12 years. Thanks to this exceptional mobilization, we know that even if Copenhagen does not achieve the goals we hoped for, the issue will not disappear from international concerns. Regardless of the time it will take, we can now believe that progress will end up being the rule. We cannot afford, however, to lose too much time. We have already too long postponed making the right decisions to preserve the Earth and its resources, and likely to guarantee a viable environment for future generations. In Antarctica, more than anywhere else, we can observe the devastating effects of climate change year after year. The problem is all the more acutely felt in the Arctic as well, which does not benefit from any true protection by any treaty. Today, we can observe that the threats weighing on the Arctic no longer concern only degradation of the biotope. The strategic stakes are now very clear, and the ambitions are more and more openly voiced. Economic appetites, of course, aroused by scientific estimations that one-fifth of the planet is still undiscovered, but technically exploitable energy resources are located in the Arctic zone. In addition to such economic appetites, there are often, unfortunately, strategic appetites. In the face of these threats, we must take action. The importance of the resources at stake can only aggravate the situation in future years. This is why it is imperative for us to set up as soon as possible a lasting international solution, taking into account everyone's interests. everyone meeting not only the five states surrounding the Arctic Ocean and its shores, part of whose indigenous populations are seeing their traditional lifestyles profoundly disrupted, but also the international community as a whole, since, I repeat, the future of the Arctic is crucial for all of us. Without any specific international treaty, the 1982 United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea serves as a basis for protection of the Arctic. And it is on this basis that all the five coastal countries recently, quote, agreed to take measures to ensure protection and conservation of the fragile marine environment of the Arctic Ocean. Can this statement weigh against the inexorable, almost daily advance of the new conquerors of these icy expanses? Given the interests involved, their power, and their complexity, it is highly unlikely that any binding agreement can help move ahead in the coming years. Thus, international negotiations cannot solve all problems. As we can observe as we approach Copenhagen, such is the major lesson of the current period. Although an effective global Arctic treaty must remain our long-term objective, we must also explore parallel courses, short-term measures for good governance, less ambitious, but just as necessary. In particular, we must envisage the creation of sanctuaries and protected areas for preserving biodiversity, including at sea, as has already been done, for example, by my country, Monaco, France, and Italy, in the Mediterranean with the Pelagos Sanctuary. This approach also applies to all phenomena linked to global warming, including the very important issue of acidification of the oceans and the threats against biodiversity. In the face of each of these challenges, we must be flexible and inventive in combining different levels of actions that are both daring and complement each other. This is why it is so important for scientists to intensify their pressure. They represent a respected, independent moral force. Today, their voice is capable of going beyond the specific interests and contingencies of topicality. While policymakers struggle to convert the conclusions of their work into appropriate choices, we must continue relying on them so we can make reason triumph tomorrow. Ladies and gentlemen, dear friends, I'd like to say a few words about the images you will discover retracing some of the Antarctic expedition that I just mentioned I was part of last January. I hope you will view this film as a human story, beyond the expedition of a few individuals visiting this beautiful but little-known continent. It retraces the everyday adventure of scientists from all horizons, from around the world, around the same hope. And they all converged in this very distant land. But most of all, I'd like you to watch this short film, which is a shorter version of a longer documentary, as a story of all of us, the story of a new century, a challenge of a generation that is about to meet its destiny. Ladies and gentlemen, dear friends, last spring I was here in Washington at the invitation of Hillary Clinton for the 50th anniversary of the Antarctic Treaty. Of all signatory countries were also present. As the Secretary of State then said, the challenges of the poles, quote, offer nations the opportunity of meeting in the 21st century, as we did 50 years ago in the 20th century, to reinforce peace and security, encourage sustainable development, and protect the environment. These very strong words trace the course that is not our own. This is, at any rate, the way I see my fight for the Poles as a determinant focal point for the future of our world. I thank you very much.
Your Highness, after working in Antarctica for several decades, it's knowing the international dimensions, it's truly remarkable to see the journey that you took and traveled around to see all the bases and to experience firsthand. I thank you for sharing that with us.
Thank you very much.
On behalf of the International Board and the Antarctic Treaty Summit, it's a great pleasure to give to you the medal.
Thank you very much. May I, in return, Paul, present you the commemorative medal of this expedition, and it's both a medal from that expedition, but also from the foundation. And thank you very much for inviting me for this celebration.
It's an honor and a pleasure.
Thank you very much.